And my guest is Paul Stamets, and he is a mycologist. We've been talking about so many different properties of mushrooms, from healing properties to immune boosting properties to absorption properties of toxins in our environment. There's just really incredibly intelligent creatures, the mycelium. And speaking of intelligence, I have a show also on the same network that George Norrie does, and the network on the GaiaMTV.com network. And Paul, I interviewed Paul Stamets on one of my shows there. You could check that out at lisasinspirations.com. There's slides, and he shows a couple of the clips from his TED Talk and also some of these pictures of the mushrooms on that show as well. And you could sign up there. And if you go to lisasinspirations.com, you'll be able to search Paul Stamets, and you'll see the interview that I did, a couple interviews I did with him on Gaia. All right, we will be back to take your calls and answer questions with Paul in just a minute. This is Lisa Garr again. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Garr, and my guest is Paul Stamets. And we're talking about mycelium, and we're talking about the incredible properties of mushrooms. Now, Paul, did you have a chance during the break to look up any of the
Yes, I
mushrooms for
did.
diabetes?
And the title of the article is Anti-Diabetic Effects of Reishi Mushrooms. It's called Ganoderma
Of course.
lucidum. And it talks about the renormalization of the insulin pathways. This is a mouse study. It's not a clinical study in humans, but many of the same pathways are operational. And it's in the journal Phytochemistry. And it was published in 2015, so it's a very recent article.
Oh, great.
And I just sent it to you, Lisa, so you
Oh,
have it in your email right now.
terrific. Thank you so much. That's great. All right, let's go back to callers. We've got a bunch of callers coming in here. Let's go to our wild card four, trucking in North Carolina, Daniel. Daniel, do you have a question for Paul Stamets?
There's a couple questions, if I may. I've been sober for about 10 years now. I used to be I guess what you would call a blackout drunk. Ever since I sobered up, my short-term memory has been really lousy. Do you think that something like the lion's head would possibly help that out, or?
Well, specifically, that's what, what lion's mane has been suggested for is improving memory. There's I think there's three small clinical studies that showed an improvement in cognition with people suffering from mild forms of dementia. Those articles are also referenced on the Huffington Post. I've written 10 articles for the Huffington Post. Each one of those covers a different mushroom, and all the research articles and the clinical studies are listed in on the Huffington Post website. So if you go to Huffington Post, put in my name, you can read up on that.
That is a great idea, and also it rebuilds the, you said, the myelin sheath around the nerve. So if you could do that, then if it actually proves to do that, then it would improve memory as well.
But these can do no harm.
Good to know.
We are at this strange junction in time with medicine, in that with the expensive clinical trials going into many millions of dollars, a lot of these things that are grasped, generally regarded as safe. There's no financial incentive for companies to finance the expensive studies because there's no patentability, so there's no protection. They can do it for the good of everyone, but in our capitalistic society, that doesn't carry us very far. So
because these are just products from nature, they're not patentable.
Right, and they have had a long history of use. Kawaguchi did get a patent on this, and it expired. I think he got the patent in 1994. So I think it's expired by now, but
Daniel, you said you had another question.
I'm actually kind of glad you just said that, because my next question, why mushrooms? I mean, last year it was red wine, the year before that it was something about tomatoes.
Good point.
Why mushrooms?
Good point. Good point.
Well, mushrooms are very rich in molecules that are not found elsewhere, and the active principal ingredients in mushrooms are now being shown to be heretofore unknown pharmaceutical agents that can help fight disease. And so mushrooms are now being re-explored as a hidden resource, ignored by the pharmaceutical industry because of the prejudice against mushrooms. I mean, the majority of you, if you tell people the next day, tomorrow, that you heard a thing about mushrooms on Coast to Coast, you're likely to get the following responses. You know, a dumb joke about being kept in the dark, you know, or people have like these really gut reactions, so to speak. Either they love them or they hate them, but they tend to get nervous around them, and the nervousness reflects their lack of knowledge. And again, when something's so powerful and you don't understand it, then it's human nature to avoid it.
Well,
because of the risk factor.
I mean, I don't think that you would actually have a psychotropic effect from a tomato. They're very misunderstood, mushrooms are, because you, as you said, you can't even look at a picture of a mushroom, compare it to a website, and know if it's safe or not. You can do that with a tomato, but it is one of those very misunderstood elements. It has such powerful properties to it that I think that's actually says a lot for it.
And Lisa, you hit the nail on the head on that one. That's exactly right. They're so powerful,
yeah,
that they scare people, but they impress people. The good news is that oncologists and medical doctors, you know, I know many, many medical doctors, and I speak at many medical conferences, and the universality of the comments are, in med school, no doctors are taught that mushrooms are good for you. They're taught that fungi are sources of disease. They're not taught that fungi, with the exception of the antibiotics, but they're not taught that fungi or mushrooms can be helpful. So they're totally at a loss. They have no knowledge base on this. And fortunately, University of Arizona Medical School, the San Francisco State University Med School, Stanford Medical School, UCLA, and many of these other schools now are very much gravitating for immune support, because
right,
there's
right.
so few things that can help people with their immunity, and this is
especially
one.
With the superbugs that are coming around these days. And by the way, thank you for your call, Daniel. I got your question. I mean, it's a good point. Is it just going to be another trend another year? But I mean, based on how many years mushrooms have been around, Paul, why hasn't there been more of a, has it been more in the media about the mushrooms, if they have that many healing properties and immune?
Well, it's increasingly more, and I'm a victim of Google Scholar alerts. I get way too many articles every week that are in the peer-reviewed scientific literature coming out on this subject. Anybody can do that on their own. It's coming out. I mean, Coast to Coast is a great vehicle, and my TED Talks have blown up, and so, you know, now the concept of mycelium is advancing, you know, and whereas the word mycelium was unknown to millions of people a few years ago, they're now recognizing it as being
right.
this very, very interesting, you know, what the mycelium is able to do is this network like design allows for something called epigenesis. And what that means is it can code for new gene sequences upon contact with a new food source, a new toxin, a new insect, fighting a new pathogen. So the network-like design of the mycelium, there's hundreds of millions of little branches that are constantly branching out at the tips. And if they encounter something, you know, if there's a reassortment of genetic material and it codes for a new enzyme, a new solution, a new antibiotic, then the whole mycelial network becomes educated. So these things are self-learning, and they're very adaptive, and this is why they've been so successful from an evolutionary point of view.
Isn't that amazing?
There's no specific place you can harm the mycelium. If you went up to a patch of mycelium on the ground and shot it with a shotgun, if it could talk, it would say, thank you. It would just fork and branch, you know. So they're extremely good at that, and I think they're a great model for new drug designs, and that's something that I'm very much involved in with a mushroom called agaricon, which is something that we've been working with a lot. It's the longest-growing mushroom in the world. It grows exclusively in the old-growth forests, And that's the mushroom that we've worked with the BioShield Biodefense Program and found extraordinary activity against viruses. And we have found extraordinary activity against bacteria as well from the same extracts of the mushrooms. So it's dually active against viruses and bacteria. And the majority of people who die from flu viruses die from bacterial pneumonia because there is they're immunologically compromised and bacteria begin to grow and they get liquid in their lungs, which is a great environment for bacteria. So finding something that's dually antiviral and antibacterial is especially good. And Lisa, I have a little story I'd love to tell you, but I think it's perfect for the Coast to Coast audience.
Okay.
Okay. Well, after 9/11, the U.S. Defense Department approached me on the BioShield program because I wrote an article in a journal that summarized in one page all the literature on the antiviral properties of mushrooms. There was only like six articles ever published. And then we submitted, over time, 700 samples of the BioShield program. We submitted our first 100. I end up getting a Federal Express package, and I'm going through the sample numbers, and they're just numbers. We didn't tell the U.S. Defense Department what mushrooms were. I just gave them sample code numbers. And then I got pox viruses, and then, sample 77 hit, 79 hit. And I looked up the sample numbers, and they were all this agaricon mushroom growing in the old growth forest. Well, soon after that, I was up in Canada, and then toom, 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 a Black Hawk helicopter shows up over our laboratories. And so our general manager calls me up and he goes, "Paul, there's a helicopter over the laboratories." And I go, "Oh, no big deal." He goes, No, it's really close." And I go, "Well, how close?" And he goes, "Listen, chomp, 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 chomp." I go, "Well, what's the number on the tail?" He goes, "There are no numbers." I said, "Uh-oh." And I said, "We just had these hits against pox viruses, and the Defense Department made a mistake. They sent me the results. They were supposed to send it to my gatekeeper at DOD." And so I got the results, and I called up this colonel. I won't mention his name, but he was the person who's in charge. And I go, "These are fantastic results." He goes, "What results?" I go, "The results that just arrived." And he goes, "You're not supposed to get those." I go, "I'll photocopy them. I'll send them to you." And so all this stuff happened, and then they realized that we're patriots, and the big concern was, if Osama bin Laden got an antidote to smallpox or something, some terrorist, then if he had the antidote, they can release a pandemic, and then you could protect the terrorists because they'd have the antidote. So I filed a patent on this in 2005, and then the U.S. Defense Department hijacked the patent out of the patent office. And after 3 or 4 years, I talked to my patent attorney and went, "Where's my blasted patent?" They haven't responded to it. He called the patent office, and National Security took the patent out of the patent office. Just like if you filed a patent on a nuclear weapon, they could do the same thing. And so through intergovernmental trace, we got a request. We got the patent away from National Security. It went to the patent office. Universality of opinion, 10 examiners approved the patent. It was approved in July 1st this past year. That's from 2005, folks. That's how long the patent's
10
been
years.
around. And then fortunately, I gave a talk in Washington, D.C., and Fort Detrick is where they, have all these intense pathogens and viruses, including smallpox. And the people there knew of my research. And then in Russia, at Vector, which is like the Fort Detrick of Russia, they came out with an article last year. And lo and behold, they said agaricon is highly active against viruses. And so I was in Washington, D.C., gave this talk to about 700 people in the audience, and I said, "We beat the Russians by 8 years." And there was a small cheer from the Fort Detrick scientists in the
Tiny chair. But what could somebody take this? First of all, is agaricon available in the U.S. in any type of health food place?
Yes, it's available as capsules in the stores.
It is.
Yes.
And if you had the, flu, could you take it? In would it actually have antiviral properties?
Well, I can give a complicated answer to a simple question. There's no clinical studies currently on agaricon against flu viruses. The BioShield Biodefense Program, using the best in vitro with human cells, determined that it was extremely antiviral. Extremely antiviral, beating the positive drug controls.
There aren't many things that can say that, right?
No. And this is we don't have very good antibiotics and very few non-toxic antivirals. And as our medical we are facing a medical crisis with MRSA, methicillin-resistant strains of Staphylococcus aureus, which
Yes.
is the bacterium that's breeding in the hospitals. So the overuse of antibiotics, and because there's no good antibiotics on the near horizon, we are facing a high degree of infection. And so having these new sources of antibiotics and antivirals that we're finding in mushrooms is a treasure trove.
Interesting.
And this is something that, you know, this...
Do you have to just take a ton of it, though, in order for it to be effective?
We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. You know, and nor can I say, and nor should I say, but we all, the research supports with NIH and the U.S. AMRID and the BioShield Biodefense Program that was set up after 9/11, using their best technologies that we have before going into animal studies, showed that the extracts of agarikon were highly active against bird flu, against hepatitis, against pox viruses, and against herpes. Herpes is an oncovirus, by the way.
Back to the staphylococcus virus, right?
And also against E. coli and staph.
Hmm.
And there's a potpourri of multiple agents. Hmm. We actually identified the anti-pox molecule, but then we went to send it to St. Jude Hospital in Tennessee to test against flu viruses. It was inactive. Well, I think that's good news. That means that the extract has more than one antiviral agent within it.
Huh. Interesting the way you look at it, yeah. Okay, well, that's great. Let's go back to phones here if we have time for one more call before the break. In east of the Rockies, central Florida, Manuel. Manuel, do you have a question for Paul Stamets?
Yes. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
How are you? And Paul, how are you?
Good.
I have a question in reference to, I have a young daughter, and she has a case of, she has extreme allergies in her.
Mm.
In a person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's everything that bothers her, dogs, cats, any type of animals, and when she goes outside, the tree pollen, the grass pollen, everything just... So the only way that I would be able to do it is take her to the doctor and have her give them like the 10 shots at a row.
Yeah, yeah.
You can maybe, if you have some type of natural mushroom.
I'm sorry. I'm not allowed to give any medical advice. So I don't know of any studies specifically or clinically on reducing allergies clinically with humans. So,
what about in the laboratory in terms of labs, animals, anything like that? Have you found anything effective?
Well, there is a down regulation of inflammatory response.
Ah.
But that is also, you know, we're somewhat handcuffed, and also there's not any research that I know clinically with humans. And so,
from which mushroom has the anti-inflammatory response?
Yeah, there's lots of this research just because of the expense. You know, they do cell wall assays, and then they do mouse studies, and that's kind of the leaping off point,
you know,
at that point in time. Or small mammals, and
but which mushroom has the anti-inflammatory properties?
The mushrooms that have the most anti-inflammatory properties, specifically, are reishi mushrooms,
mm-hmm.
and chaga, which is a birch polypore. Those are two that are known to have strong anti-inflammatory properties. Many of these mushrooms have those same properties, but those are two.
So does
stellar candidates.
So does turmeric or turmeric, however you want to say that, and that's also a lot of information on the internet about its anti-inflammatory properties. It's not a mushroom, but there's a long history on that as well. My daughter has a little friend who's the same way, and it is definitely hard to watch the level of tolerance that these kids have for the allergies. So thank you so much for your phone call, Manuel. I really appreciate you stepping up and calling in. Appreciate that. Reishi holds its form for a long time, doesn't it? Isn't that the one that is looks like it's petrified when you get it off of the tree? Is that the reishi mushroom?
These are wood conchs. So
mm-hmm.
where oyster mushrooms come up and go away in 4 or 5 days, these wood conchs stay around for months. Some are perennial. Like a agarikon will grow for, we think, up to 100 years.
Wow.
It was up for 100 years in the wet rainforests of Washington State, Oregon, Northern California, British Columbia.
Huh.
And it doesn't rot. It has an immune system that we can learn from.
Interesting.
So that's why these polypore mushrooms are so fascinating. They have the ability to withstand a lot of stress factors and a lot of pathogens that are trying to consume it.
Interesting. All right, we are going to take another quick break. Come back with Paul and your phone calls after the break. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. So if you've been following the show, you understand why my guest is an award-winning mycologist, Paul Stamets. He has spent over 30 years studying and being dedicated to the study of mushrooms, mushroomology. I don't know if that's a term or not. But we certainly have learned a lot tonight. We're going to continue to take your calls after the break and find out more about various, you know, questions that are coming in about mushrooms. I have no idea that we could actually have such a deep topic on the, I mean, subject here, matter going on. We've got pest control and nuclear waste absorption and medicinal properties of mushrooms, immune boosting properties of mushrooms. So a lot more to learn. And I also wanted to mention that I also do a radio show during the week, which is called The Aware Show, and you can look it up online. It's theawareshow.com if you want to track any of the other guests that I do on alternative health or personal development. It's all on there. I also have a book coming out, and you can look that up at theawareshow.com/book and find out more about what I do. So I would love to see you there as well. We will be back with my guest, Paul Stamets, after the break. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest is award-winning mycologist, Paul Stamets. I had a caller come in, actually an email come in about Nevada Bob. He was asking about specific fungi for human waste septic systems. Are you aware of any of those?
Well, yes. We received a $80,000 EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, Phase 1 grant, specifically on using the garden giant mushroom that I mentioned that attracted the bees, using that mushroom to clean up E. coli. And we published this in the Journal of Ecological Engineering. If you go to our website, fungi.com, F-U-N-G-I.com, there's three articles that we have posted up there that you can download. And this is this test was basically a proof of concept test that showed that the mycelium removed 20% of the E. coli per cubic foot of mycelium, per 2/3 of a cubic foot of mycelium, which is quite substantial. And how I originally discovered this, I live in a small waterfront farm, 20 acres here on Skookum Inlet, and when I moved here in 1984. I was here a week, and the sheriff showed up, and I thought that was awfully quick. I didn't even have a chance to do anything yet. And every landowner on this inlet was served a summons saying you had to replace your septic system within 2 years. It would be physically forced off your property. I bought this farm. It had small cows, chickens, and pigs on it, and I put in the garden giant mushroom in a swale, and the depression going into that went down to the salt water where there's shellfish beds and salmon and trout. And they came back a year later. I could not afford to put in my septic system. The bio burden dramatically had increased because I had more animals. They more than doubled the next year, as most people know. But we had more than 100-fold reduction of E. coli. That was the birth of what we call mycofiltration, M-Y-C-O filtration. And then that led, it took a long time, but it led to an environmental EPA grant. Now we've proved that it works. And so this is basically a sheet mulch of wood chips about a foot deep that's given the spawn, and then through infiltration, through the surging or the passage of water carrying the E. coli, it captures it, and it breaks it down, and the mycelium actually eats it as a food source.
Interesting. So what could somebody develop that on their own?
Yeah, this is a totally open source. You know, we sell spawn of it, and the mushrooms can be up to 5 pounds per specimen. They're up to 2 feet across. It's called the garden giant for good reason. They're Godzilla mushrooms, and they're huge. And they're very edible and choice when they're young, and the mushrooms don't have any E. coli in them. You always cut off the base of the stem just in case there's ground contact, and you should always cook mushrooms. Don't eat mushrooms raw. They give you almost no nutritional value raw. Mushrooms should be cooked, unless they're truffles. And the exception is if you put them in vinegar. But the rule of thumb for sure is that mushrooms should be cooked. And then if there's any resident bacteria that's carried along, then it's quickly denatured when you put them in a frying pan.
Okay, so that's actually really good to know. So you can do this for septic systems or wherever you are, and basically, or if you someone talked about the solar toilets.
Well, there's a bunch of people in Northern California using the garden giant mushroom in replace of a septic system. There is one county, I'm not going to mention it because I don't want to get legally anybody in trouble, but one of the counties that if there's a non-detect, it's not a problem. What that means is if they can't detect an E. coli coming from your property, then it's not an issue. So they put a garden giant mushroom beds in not having to put in a septic system because they didn't have the permeability and everything else, the money, et cetera. So, but as an adjunct, as a better management practice, I don't like to use the word best management practice, but as an improved management practice, you sheet mulch. I mean, if anyone gets anything from this, put the wood on the ground, let it rot. That's how you increase biodiversity, increase the humus layer or organic matter. Is the mycelium is the best way of sequestering carbon and building the carbon bank, the carbon underground using mushroom mycelium is probably the most immediate thing that we can do to start tilting the balance to a better climate. And for, most people don't realize that when mycelium rots wood, 20% of that wood becomes water. Mycelium generates water.
Awesome. Wow.
So, and it hydrates the habitat as it grows.
Mm-hmm.
And so it breaks down the lignin and cellulose, and it grabs oxygen out of the atmosphere, combines it with hydrogen, and you get H2O. You get water. So 20% of straw and wood by mycelium becomes free water. And so myceliated habitats are moist habitats. They're spongy, and they retain water for the ecological benefit of the diverse communities that depend upon them.
Hmm. Fascinating. So a lot of people are asking about the morel mushroom, about hunting the morel mushroom. What is the morel mushroom?
A morel mushroom is a honeycomb, spongy-like mushroom that grows in the spring. I have a YouTube channel, and I've been growing morels outdoors. I grew like 400 of them outdoors,
wow,
right 20 feet from where I'm speaking right now. And if you go to youtube.com/Paul Stamets, you'll see several morel videos of growing morels and you're, outside. And so morels are, this is great because it's May is morel month. That's the adage.
Oh.
We're coming up on this, and Mother's Day is morel day. I'll give you a little secret. That's when everyone's out hunting morels is on Mother's Day.
What's a morel, the property of a morel? Why are they so
popular? One of the most delicious of mushrooms. People are passionate about them. They're very fickle in that they grow in very select habitats directly after burns. So the big forest fires are in California, Yosemite, et cetera. That's where the morels are this year. They don't show up the next year. One year after a burn, they show up.
And that's it.
Let's
go to our wild card line here in Kansas. Corey, what's your question about morels? You're one of many who are asking about them.
Yeah, you just pretty much answered it. Just what makes them so fickle? Like, I've been hunting mushrooms for 20 years, and this particular year has been the biggest year ever. We're literally finding hundreds every couple days.
Well,
wow.
What is your address, please?
How long will they continue to come up?
Well, it depends on your habitat. If there's are you in a burned area, or what state are you in?
This is southeast Kansas, and we have a lot of strip pit land around here where the strip mines, the miners came in, they stripped the land of the coal, and they left these big dumps.
Yep. Okay, so that's mineral earth and disturbed habitat. So you're in a disturbed, the mushrooms. This is so interesting because many of us mycologists think that morels are vanguard species. When the ground is all turned up and has been devastated, these sinful morels come up. They attract insects, and then deer come in. They like, and other animals come in to get their morels, and this is part of the habitat regenerating. But that disturbed habitat environment, maybe 2 years, if there's new disturbed habitat, a lot of times morels show up around construction sites where there's gypsum board or sheetrock laid down. And where there's new, you know, in Washington State here is where beauty bark is put down, a new construction. They also grow underneath cottonwoods and underneath old abandoned apple orchards. I mean, it's really, there's a new article that was just published in Mycologia just 3 days ago. That's the mycological journal that describes all the different species of morels, and there's a whole bunch of them. So lots of those species are probably in different species and different ecological niches. But
what are you going to do with all of them, Corey?
eat the heck out of them.
Eat them.
Bring them up. I mean, I am so jealous of you. Seriously. Give me your address. I'm flying out there.
I pretty much believe Paul will do that. Thanks for your call, Corey. Another question coming in from our wild card line in Long Beach, California. David, do you have a question for Paul Stamets?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. My father has multiple sclerosis, which causes a little bit of plaquing on the brain and the degeneration of the myelin because of the immune system attacking it. And I was wondering if you had a recommendation on anything you could take for that. And another thing you mentioned, which was you should always cook your mushrooms. What if they're dry? Does that matter?
Okay, the first question, you use words that are very sensitive. I can't use the word recommendation. I'm not allowed to diagnose a disease or suggest that these mushrooms can prevent it in humans. I'm not allowed to do that. So I recommend that you go to a doctor who is skilled, who can make those recommendations, who's informed about the subject, who's read the literature, is up the learning curve, and then they can make a medical recommendation. I'm not a doctor, I'm a mycologist. Now, in terms of dried mushrooms, after you dry them, you can rehydrate them and you should cook them. You can put them in soup, but they should be tenderized because the chitinous-like walls, the cell walls, are not digestible. Now, you can do this experiment, and after all, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, here on the West Coast. But I did this. You can take a small shiitake mushroom, whole, that's raw, and swallow it. Don't chew it up, just swallow it. Then when you go to the bathroom the next morning, you know, and you look in the toilet, the mushroom will come out whole, totally undigested. Now, if you take that same mushroom, well, not the exact same mushroom, but if you take and you cooked it, and then you swallowed it whole, it's fully digested. So mushrooms should be cooked because otherwise they're not digestible.
Ah, you've done your own experimentation. To his question, though, which one of the mushrooms is the most powerful for boosting the immune system?
Wow, that is such a, you know, I am a big believer in multiple species. I take a 17 mushroom species blend called My Community. We know from the experiments that we did in Japan that one mushroom may activate a field of receptor sites, but not all of them. And the architecture molecularly of each mushroom will activate different subsets of the remaining receptors. And so it speaks to the adage that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And it's very much been seen with mushrooms is taking a multiple mushroom species activates an immune system far better than any one species by itself. And we're all a little bit different. We're dialed in a little bit differently. And our microbiomes, these mushrooms are looked upon now. Turkey tail mushrooms are known as, two articles came out this past year, they're prebiotics for the microbiome. They actually enhance Acidophilus and Bifidobacterium, two beneficial bacteria, and they inhibit the inflammatory bacteria in your gut. So these mushrooms and the compatibility of your microbiome with the mushrooms, this is why you meet some people who don't like mushrooms. It could be their microbiomes are not compatible. But I think so. I think, you know, having an assortment of mushrooms in a blend is much better than having one species, because we just don't know enough now about what your molecular landscape is in terms of your microbiomes and the receptivity of these mushrooms that are activating your immune system. We just don't know enough.
Interesting. Thank you so much for your call. Now, that My Community blend, is that something that comes from the internet, or you can get that?
It's in Whole Foods. It's in the vitamin shop. You know, it's on our website at fungi.com.
Great to know. Okay. All right. Thank you. And actually, there's another question coming in, about kind of the same concept, from the east of the Rockies, Albert Lea, New Mexico. PJ, do you have a question for Paul Stamets?
Yeah, it's elderly Minnesota, not
Sorry.
New Mexico.
Sorry, I'm dyslexia is happening over here.
I was going to ask Paul if there's contradictions between mushroom species for consumption. That is to say, should I not be taking a lion's mane capsule if I'm eating morels or puffballs?
That's a great question. And my simple answer is there's no contraindications. However, like I have a slight allergy to chanterelles, which are, everyone eats chanterelles, but if they're not cooked well enough, I get a little bit flushed. So there's idiosyncratic reactions. You will know just from your self-experimentation. So that's a really excellent question, because the pharmacology of the interaction of the mushrooms that you've mentioned, the morels contain hydrazines, and hydrazines are toxic. So morels in particular, you should not eat raw morels. You should always cook morels. So if you had uncooked morels combined with puffballs that were cooked, you know, you could get a negative reaction there. That's why, just to be safe, cook all mushrooms.
Oh, good. So that's what you were talking about earlier about
it. Very good question. And, you know, self-experimentation here is, you know, each person is going to be a little bit different. And what I find also very funny, sometimes people go, I pick up the mushrooms out of my meal because I don't like them. Well, mushrooms contain glutamates. They contain, which are flavor enhancers. So when you cook mushrooms in a meal, the meal tastes better because of the flavor-enhancing glutamate.
Oh, interesting.
Glutamates.
Yes.
So when people pull them away, they're actually taking away the mushrooms.
Flavor.
But the meal tastes better because of the flavor enhancers that are coming from the mushrooms.
Huh. Very interesting. Wow. Well, thank you very much for your question. And there's still so much to learn that you have spent years and years. Where's the best place for people to visit to find out more information in terms of articles and so forth?
Well, fungi.com, F-U-N-G-I.com. Yeah, I registered that name myself for $25.
Wow, long time ago, huh?
Long time ago. I've been on the internet for a while.
Mm-hmm.
The North American Mycological Association, NAMYCO.org, NAMYCO.org. The Mycological Society of America, that's kind of the heavy hitter scientific organization. All of those have jump points to a whole bunch of other websites that have different specialities. And there's one that we love called mushroomobserver.com or .org.
Hmm.
Mushroom is Observer. That is where you find a mushroom and you don't know what it is. You send a photograph to that website. It's juried by a bunch of experts who oftentimes argue with each other.
Oh, that's interesting.
But Mushroom Observer is a really good place for anybody listening out there saying, I got a mushroom, I don't know what it is. Or
right.
I have a morel. Or is it really a morel? And these people are top notch. And so they provide a very good service.
Those are the questions that we have left here, is about a mushroom in a yard and a morel. So that's good.
Never eat a mushroom unless it's positively identified by an expert. So no one should just base identification from a photograph. You know, you should really confirm it in person with a mycologist, just to be extra sure.
And you should also cook them, is what you're saying.
Yes.
If you're going to eat them. And then the agarikon, though, if those, do they maintain their properties if you cook them?
Agarikon mushrooms are an endangered species in Europe. These are massive mushrooms. You can't cook them. They're hard wood.
Oh, right. They're huge.
So, the mycelium is we have is freeze-dried, so that lasts a very long time.
Are they expensive?
No. I mean, they're rare, but once we have them in culture, they can be grown
all over
sustainably. So we have the largest strain library of agarikon in the world right now, 65 strains. They're very hard to find. One out of 100 times in the old growth forest will we find them. And
wow.
Our culture library has been called a national treasure because it's has a diversity of strains that can be very important for fighting pandemics.
Thank you so much, Paul. Paul Stamets is my guest. It's been fabulous, fascinating conversation. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. And also, I want to thank Lisa Lyon and George Norrie and Tom Danheiser, Gina Salvati, and Brian Oprey here, and engineer, and Nathan Staten in phones over there. And I want to thank you for listening. Thank you so much for joining me this evening. your energy makes these shows happen, and your contribution to the calls and the questions that you ask just makes the show happen and that much better. Thank you so much. And until next time, I invite you all to stay aware.